culture and people wondering how the dead zones got there. But there are a lot of places in West Virginia that are already haunted. I've driven through there, and it's like there's some roads and highways that just suck the energy right out of me. Just the haints are everywhere. God. And some of the roads get me lost.
That's easy to have happen around here.
Go. Head On with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Whoa, howdy! America's blustering downer rides again. Coming up on 2 minutes past the hour of 6 p.m. here on the East Coast. 2 past 3 on the West Coast. And somewhere either ahead or behind for the rest of the world. Welcome to this Thursday evening edition of Head On. I'm Bob Kincaid. And I'd like to start with something rather... special, I guess you could call it. Be very quiet. We're hunting the great American yellow-bellied red-necked wingnut. They've become quite rare. There's one over there. It turns out that I got this little piece of copy from the blog provided to me by our chat room moderator, ELO. A comment posted by someone who calls himself Matt Sanders. MottCross202@yahoo.com. And he writes, and I might add, not very literately, he is, after all, a wingnut. Hello, I, that's with a small I, you know, a minuscule I. Do we have self-esteem issues, Matt? Hello, I am a 22-year-old student guard serviceman. I came upon your program through iTunes. That's THREW through. Matt, buddy. Hint one, wingnut. Spell check is your friend. Grammar check is your buddy. I came upon your program through iTunes. I personally don't know where you get your funding, but the topics and the way that you are defending your positions makes me laugh at you. Well, Matt, see? Then we're equal because we're already all laughing at you. Because you're a moron. See, it's not my job to defend my topics. I never voted for George W. Bush. I didn't vote my way into a $3 trillion war that we can't win. I didn't vote my way into a collapsing economy, a health care disaster, the response to Katrina, or September 11th, Matt. arguably, at some point in the past, you did, at least in 2004, if you're 22, as you say, and not some puzzle-gutted 57-year-old who is a member of the 101st Fighting Keyboardists, clacking away in your jammies somewhere. I'm an independent voter. Yeah, we can tell, Matt. You're about as independent, well, but by listening to your program, I hope to God, that's little g God. Why do you hate God, Matt? Why can't you put a capital G on God? That a person with your kind of disease does not take control of this country. Oh, you better hope so, Matt, because if a person like me takes control of the country, you're going to the gulag. Yeah. There's an idealistic world that you and your liberal friends live in. Oh, remember, he was an independent, but he's, you know, he's decided that, oh, your liberal friends. Well, I am a liberal. Absolutely. While conservatives allow you to have your freedom and your outlandish views, I'll be damned. I had no idea that my freedoms stemmed from conservatives. I thought they stemmed from the Constitution. But at least Matt is good enough to acknowledge that he and his conservative pals don't acknowledge constitutional rights anymore. Conservatives give us liberals rights. He says, I listen to many of talk radio shows in my area. Many of talk radio shows. And there seems to be a distinct difference between theirs, that's T-H-E-R-E apostrophe S, and yours. Is this guy in the Guard because of the diminished enlistment standards brought about by the desperation for recruitment? T-H-E-R-E apostrophe S? Jesus, Matt, you do know which end of the gun shoots, don't you, buddy? Or do they let you handle the firearms? The people that I listen to, John Justice, Laura Ingraham, Jerry Doyle, etc., all come off in a conservative manner, but they never just jibber-jabber about how dumb someone sounded or how much medication they must have been on. I don't know, Matt, how much medication you must have been on to come up with sentences like these. You see, we're talking about how dumb you are, Matt, because you're displaying how dumb you are in your attempt at typing. It rather screams off the page. But anyway, he says that Laura Ingraham, John Justice, I've never heard of John Justice. He must be like a sixth or seventh or eighth tier right-wing hate monger. They talk about real problems that we are facing at the moment. Which ones are those? Are they out there talking about the problems we face because the taxpayer's treasury was looted to bail out Bear Stearns, Matt? No, they're not. Are they talking about the real problems we face from the subprime crunch that was created by your Republican cronies, Matt? No, they're not doing that either. See, I check in with some of these freaks once in a while, Matt. And they tend to talk about the danger to America from brown people. And how John McCain-Turian candidate McSame isn't conservative enough. That's what they talk about. They talk about real problems and real problems that we are facing at the moment because they understand a simple fact about life: you can't change the past. I don't think anyone here is trying to change the past, Matt. But you know what? There's a word for the past. It's called, Matt, are you paying attention, Matt? It's called history. Can you say that, Matt? History? Good, I thought you could. You get a cookie now. And you can't change history. But Matt, and I understand this is difficult for you, what with you being a moron and all, if you don't learn from history, you're more than likely going to repeat it. Sort of like the little addle-pated, jug-eared, pig-eyed louse who occupies the White House didn't learn any history, even though Yale University gave him a degree in it. He didn't learn any history. He didn't learn anything about Vietnam. So he went ahead and repeated the mistakes of Vietnam. See, there's a real clear example for you, Matt. Do you get it? Good boy. Decisions, he says, are made every day that may lead to a difficult future, but the people that give up liberals is in parentheses, when the tough gets going, man, this is like postmodern poetry. The people that only see the negative and never look for a compromised solution are the ones that the failure in Iraq will be placed on if it happen, cause if shouldn't. You know, I think I need one of those National Security Administration Cray supercomputers to translate that last one. Let's see if we can parse this out. I know, Republicans hate parsing language, but let's see if we can. Decisions are made every day that lead to a difficult future. Well, that's precisely... Good boy, Matt. It looks like there's a learning curve inside your little attempt at language. Decisions are made every day that make life more difficult. Lots of those decisions have been made in the last 8 years. And they were made by that pusillanimous little punk in the White House. His name, Matt, by the way, in case it's escaped you, is George W. Bush. And he's not very smart, just like you. Kind of shows how far you can rise in the world, doesn't it? You should be inspired, Matt. Decisions are made every day that may lead to a difficult future, but the people that give up liberals when the tough gets going... Now, see, Matt, that's why this show's here. We haven't given up. We're determined to wrest this republic back from fascist little bastards like you at virtually any cost. Because, you see, liberals, Matt, are patriots. We're proud patriots. Our brothers and sisters, our aunts and uncles, our fathers, our mothers have struggled and fought and died, grandfathers, great-grandfathers, in labor struggles, in wars, in battles, in the fight for civil rights, Matt, in the fight to make this country live up to its potential, while people like you and your forebears have desperately struggled to turn it into a fascist dictatorship. So there's no giving up in us, Matt. There, as we say down south, ain't no quit in us. We don't know the meaning of quit, Matt. We will fight you and your dirty comrades, your filthy fascist pals, to the very last. Because we understand what the stakes are in this struggle, Matt. We understand that this is a struggle for the very future of America. Because you want America to be an empire, Matt. And history, remember that's the new word we learned a little bit ago, Matt? History? History says that empires all collapse, every last one of them. And we don't want to be an empire, Matt, because we don't want to collapse. I know I'm using a lot of big words. You can ask a liberal to explain some of them to you. But he goes on. Let's see. Let's go back to that twisted poetic sentence. When the people that only see the negative and never look for a compromised solution are the ones that the failure in Iraq will be placed on if it happens, because if shouldn't. Well, Matt, buddy, we haven't caused the failure in Iraq. Your buddy George Bush has. Because your buddy George Bush is what they call, and here's another big word for you, a couple of them. George Bush is what you call a miserable failure, Matt. I realize you've got a lot of work to do with all these big words I've handed you, but you know what? We're liberals, Matt, and we have faith that, you know, if you kind of put your tongue between your teeth and you think real hard with that thinking thing between your ears, you might figure some of this out. Private Pyle. And he continues, United America... Okay, United America... United, America... Okay, this is apparently a reference to an airline and our country. Oh, I see. United America can accomplish what it needs to do. I agree. United, Matt, without ignorant little fascist punks like you, we can pull together and we can take care of America's needs. We can have health care for every American. We can have a reasonable tax structure that doesn't ask working people to carry America on its backs and give tax breaks to the multi-billionaires who sit around eating lark's vomit canapes. Okay, Matt? Good for you. You got one right. See, I told you. You're not the moron you think you are. Oh, never mind. I take it back. And right now, America needs to defeat Islamic terrorist. Just one. Just one. Matt only wants us to defeat one Islamic terrorist. I wish he would have told us which one, because I would have been happy to go out and whip him. I mean, as long as, you know, it's one and done, there you go. America, and right now, America needs to defeat Islamic terrorist. How about the other terrorists, Matt? Do we not need to defeat them, too? Because, you see, we've got other terrorist problems besides the Islamic one. We have a terrorist problem with a guy who sent anthrax to elected Democratic leaders in Congress back in 2001, Matt. And your buddy George in the White House hasn't done a blessed thing to catch that murderous bastard. But you're not much interested in that because he's not Islamic, are you, Matt? Oh, we have real problems in this country besides Islamic terrorist, whichever one it is that you're talking about. Why, we have a Christian fundamentalist terrorist in Oklahoma by the name of Sally Kern. Have you heard of her, Matt? She's the one who says that gay people are worse than Timothy McVeigh, who blew up the Murrah Federal Building. Do you remember Timothy McVeigh, Matt? If you're 22, you might not, because that would be back when you were riding to school on the short bus, buddy. See, Timothy McVeigh was a right-wing Christian fundamentalist terrorist. He was a Republican, Matt, just like you. Because liberals will get... Because they are and will destroy this country along with the help of brainwashing of the liberal mindset. Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, I am a trained professional reader. Do not try this at home. And you know what, ELO, if there's anybody out there that doubts a word of what I'm reading, you feel free to post it in the chat room at headonradionetwork.com. That way people can pop in and have a look at this ignorance. Okay, so, and right now America needs to defeat Islamic terrorist, one of them, period. because they are and will destroy this country along with the help of the brainwashing of the liberal mindset. You know, I'm a pretty smart guy, and I don't run around bragging about my IQ or anything. It's a lot higher than Matt's. But I can't even begin to fathom that sentence. I don't know what it means. Because they are and will destroy this country along with the help of the brainwashing of the liberal mindset. Okay, let's try the next sentence. I honestly pray to God, G-O-D, all caps. Last time it was G-O-D, all minuscules. Maybe he's trying to make up for the previous insult to his supreme deity. I honestly pray to God that liberals will get their heads, that's T-H-E-R-E heads, you know, will get their heads out of their, T-H-E-R-E again, asses. Werewolf? Their wolf. Their castle. Get their heads out of their asses before they allow another 9/11 to happen. Matt, you haven't listened enough, buddy. You don't know the hell I take for not saying that George Bush personally ordered September 11th to happen. But if there was anyone who let September 11th happen, Matt, you poor benighted fool, he see, he name calls. He just name calls. He can't refute him. He's just calling him names. It's Bob's way or the highway, I tell you. It is. But, Matt, really, are you under the impression, because you are an impressionable young man who doesn't know words like history, are you under the impression, Matt, that somebody besides George W. Bush was president on September 11th, 2001? Or have you come here like that guy they talk about on the Art Bell program who's a time traveler? Did you come here from some other universe where George W. Bush wasn't president on September 11th, 2001? Do you come from a universe where September 11th, 2001 happened on the watch of, say, President Gore? No, really. Because, see, Matt, if anybody let September 11th happen, it's George W. Bush and Dick Cheney and Condi Rice and Wolfowitz and Pearl and all the other creepy little PNAC people who had their eyes over on Iraq looking for a way to, you know, attack Saddam because, as George noted in a speech, he tried to kill my daddy. I honestly pray to God that liberals will get their heads out of their asses before they allow another 9/11 to happen. It will if we do not keep the pressure on. That's a fact you can't talk your way out of, all caps. I got a lot of dust on my screen here. Wait a minute, I'm just... No, that... Okay, that is a period. It will if we do not keep the pressure on. Then all caps, that's a fact that you can't talk your way out of. No, but I can reason my way out of it, Matt. That's a fiction that you cannot reason your way into. Please stop your radio show for the sake of your country. No, Matt, we're going to keep the radio show going for the sake of our country. Because left to the likes of you, this country is, what's the word I'm looking for here? I don't want to use a great big $4 or $5 or $10 word because I wouldn't want to be confusing you, Matt. With the likes of you growing up and running this country, we're, oh, come on, screwed. And then Matt says, "I'll pray for you." Yeah, that's definitely a dust speck. That's not an apostrophe. ILL, pray for you. Ill, pray for you. Don't pray for me, Matt. Prayer is for chumps. What you can do, since you're a great big heroic student guard serviceman, you can pick up the telephone. And I'll put you right on the air, Matt. I'll even pay for the call. 877. Now, get your crayon out, Matt. You're going to need to write this down. 877-443-2366. That's 877, and the next one is a 4. That's, yeah, you know what 4 looks like. And then HEADON. It's kind of, you know how they got letters on the telephone keypad? When you have a hard time picking out what the numbers look like, Matt, you can spell it with letters. 877-4-HEADON. And apparently he likes to be called, and I'm sorry, I should have been doing this all along for Matt Sanders, he likes to be called Matt-Matt, because that's how he signed his letter. I'll pray for you, Matt-Matt. Aw, isn't that sweet? I bet his mama called him Matt-Matt when he was little. Give the name of the hate speak guy you didn't recognize once again, please. Then we can Google him and likely figure out what benighted burg has to put up with this boob living in it. Oh, my God, that's precious. Let's see. The guy I've never heard of is John Justice. He's John Justice for truth, the American way, and here's John Justice. What do you want to bet he's got a line or something like that? I know how these. I understand. I know the dodge. John Justice. Jerry Doyle. Jerry Doyle, you should. If you've never heard the opening of Jerry Doyle's program, Jerry Doyle is an honorary astronaut. Jerry Doyle was on the Emmy Award winning series Babylon 5. Bill Doberman will clean your windows. Bill Doberman supports families. Jerry Doyle. Then he says he's an independent, and that he left the Republican Party left him. He didn't leave the Republican Party. Oh, you should hear this guy. He's a genuine fourth tier twit. See, it's early in the evening, and I'm not using the fun language while the kiddies might be around. Oh, my, I'm in trouble again. That was pretty vicious bullying, Bob. He's only spewing back what he hears from right-wing radio. He may live in an area where there's no other media. He's 22. Most high school grads can't even read. Could use this as an opportunity to teach, not bully, please. Nah, because, see, that's the thing. He came into our house bullying. And there's only one way to deal with a bully. And that is to punch the bully in the face. Because, see, we'll never hear from Matt Sanders, student guardsman. We won't get a call from Matt. I won't get an email from Matt at bob@headonradio.com. Because Matt is a bully. Matt has been trained to be a bully. And being a bully, when you punch them in the face and bloody up their nose real, real good, they run away. Because they're cowards at their very cores. And I'm sorry, Kate, dear. I mean, you know... I really appreciate the input and everything, but we have played nicey with the bullies long enough. I don't think this is our John Justice, Mark Levine. John Justice spent 20 years in prison for killing four people before his release. Now he's back in jail for at least the next 9 years. Justice tells Two on Your Side the halfway house where he stayed after prison was not a good place. Then again, he said, Mark, I don't know, this may be him. He sounds like a right-winger, doesn't he? But no, in all seriousness, this guy came into our house spewing filth at us. And you can't teach one of these. Somebody has had hold of him for 22 years, filling his head with filth. Matt Sanders is a permanent part of the problem. He will never be part of the solution. Matt Sanders believes that the way you solve a problem is by shooting at it. So, if this had been somebody who was honestly seeking dialogue, I'd be all for doing the dialogue with him, because this is, after all, conversation radio. Feeling kind of uncomfortable for Matt, this would be a good opportunity to discuss the lack in our educational system. He hasn't been brought up like you and I. That's right, he didn't have good raising. He weren't raised right. But the thing is, neither was Timothy McVeigh. And when you get right down to it, there's probably not 10 cents worth of difference between Matt Sanders and Timothy McVeigh. Because they see solutions in things exploding and limbs flying around. They see killing someone for their religious belief as a means of securing America's future. I'm the first guy in the world, I hope, that would reach out to somebody who is seriously deluded like Matt is. But Matt did not engage in a dialogue. He took his barely functional literacy and brought a knife to a gunfight. So, no, I understand the impetus behind your discomfort. But you know what? It's always discomfort. It's always discomforting watching people display the profundity of their own ignorance. Let's see. A couple other comments rolling in. The Heretic writes in and says, as a huge Babylon 5 fan, it was especially painful to learn that Jerry Doyle was a giant right-wing jackass. I've heard some clips from his show. Ugh! Oh, yeah. Yeah, Jerry... because Babylon 5 was a pretty damn cool show, coming from a person who likes sci-fi stuff. But, Lord God, you should hear the intro to his program. For 10 years, he was a highly successful stockbroker on Wall Street. Then he took a role in Babylon 5, where he did not win any of the Emmys to which he refers in this introduction. And he's an honorary junior astronaut. You know, we just... go listen to just about any liberal talker. From the highest to the lowest. From the east to the west, the north to the south. Well, okay, I'm the only one in the south. Malloy's in the south. And they're all pretty straightforward. You know, here's Tom Hartman. Here's Bob Kincaid. Here's Mike Malloy. Here's Stephanie Miller. Here's Randy Rhodes. But when it's a right-wing yakker... He was on Babylon 5, and he's an honorary astronaut. Because, you see, simple-minded right-wingers buy into that kind of garbage. They buy into that kind of silliness, that kind of foolishness. I'd welcome hearing from poor, pathetic little Matt. And I've never run anybody off air yet. Good God, back in the bad old days of terrestrial radio, I used to sit and remonstrate with these morons until I thought my head would explode. Taking those teaching moments, taking those opportunities to painfully explain to them how desperately wrong their positions were and how poisonous their positions were to their own best interests. So I learned some hard lessons talking, you know, to the great American yellow-bellied redneck, sapsucker, whatever. Yeah, I know, Koss. All you damn liberal talkers are nothing but haters. You hate mom and apple pie, too. Well, I don't hate apple pie. I mean, I got to admit, I'm a little more partial to blackberry cobbler, but that's communist. Oh, dear. I fear the train is off the rails already this evening. Whatever shall we do? We had some great conversations last night. I hope we'll have them again tonight. I'm seeing some breaking news in the chat room, and I'd love to see some copy on this. Monique has popped in to say that, did you hear that Governor Siegelman is being released on bail while he appeals? Or on bond. And I hope that, God, I hope that's true. Although, knowing the desperation of the Bush administration Justice Department, I wouldn't see an emergency appeal to the Supreme Court. Please, please, Justice Tony, make him stay in the can where he can't run his mouthus. But, you know, they did their job, too. It's a lot like Spitzer. Since Siegelman came first, you have to say that Spitzer got Siegelman. You can't say that Siegelman got Spitzered. It is achieving, it's a matter of achieving a short-term solution, no matter the cost, that gets somebody out of the way long enough to consolidate right-wing power. So, you know, that's what, I'm sorry, we don't hear from wing nuts very much anymore because they are so confounded rare. Here's John Justice. Wait a minute. ELO found him. You can't hide anything from ELO.
104.1 FM, The Truth. Tucson's News FM. Morning 6 to 9, The John Justice Show.
One of these photographs shot from beneath so that all you see is his voluminous neck. Okay, so, I don't know. Apparently Matt is either listening online, I don't know if they know how to stream, or else he is somewhere out in the wilds of Arizona. Anyway, you slice it, Matt's part of the problem and not part of the solution. So there you have it. A little fun to begin with. Simply because, well, I take pleasure in playing with wing nuts the way that a cat takes pleasure in letting the mouse sit in the corner for a few minutes before dissecting it. Morons, morons, morons. An abundance of morons. And that is, in fact, part and parcel of the problem with our country. Millions and millions of mats who are willing to believe anything that comes out of the speaker on their 76 AMC pacer. It is what it is. We'll take a little break for a musical interlude and come back. You're listening to America's Liberal Voice. You're listening to The Horn. I'm Bob Kincaid.
Never took a paper or a learned degree.
Hey, can I pick him or what? XTC, the mayor of Simpleton. Oh, man. You can take the DJ out of the rock and roll radio booth, but you can't take the rock and roll out of the DJ. Okay, the Siegelman story. Let's get this kind of squared away real quick. At first, I thought maybe it wasn't what I had hoped. Associated Press story from 2 hours ago, the House Judiciary Committee asking the Justice Department today to allow imprisoned former Alabama Governor Don Siegelman to testify before Congress about possible political influence over his prosecution, and Attorney General Michael Mukasey. Oh, God, all you got to do is read his name and you know what the answer is going to be. We are not inclined to let Mr. Siegelman out of his cell. Michael Mukasey indicated, he didn't say, he indicated, journalese, indicated that he would not support the request for a temporary release. I don't know by what, you know, hand signals, smoke signals, he indicated. One word. Sounds like blow. No. Okay. Indicated he would not support the request for a temporary release, but said that officials might arrange for Siegelman's testimony in some other way. Under the committee's plan, Siegelman, a Democrat, sentenced to serve more than 7 years for something that isn't even illegal, would travel to Washington in May under guard of the U.S. Marshals Service. Jesus. Said Melanie Russell, a spokesman for the committee. Committee Chairman John Conyers, who's generally a decent human being, believes Siegelman, quote, would have a lot to add to the committee's investigation into selective prosecution. Traveling in California, Mukasey said of the request, I suppose if they really want to talk to him, there must be a way to do it by remote hookup. We generally don't let people out of jail until they're dead, dead, dead. A member of Siegelman's defense team said he's delighted to cooperate. So that was the beginning. And then this story from an hour ago. And this is the hooray part. An appeals court this afternoon ordered former Governor Don Siegelman released from prison pending appeal. You know, he's been in some hellhole in Louisiana. There is evidence to suggest that Don Siegelman has been mistreated, beaten. He was denied access to even something as simple as the tools necessary to write a letter out, being forced to write on Xerox copies of newspaper articles. The 11th Circuit Court of Appeals said the governor had shown he was not a flight risk, that he was not appealing for the purpose of delay, and that his conviction, quote, raised substantial questions of law or fact. And of course it does, because Siegelman's conviction is a complete Rovian fabrication founded on nothing but lies and, frankly, some of the most unethical lawyer conduct that this country has witnessed in quite some time. Assistant U.S. Attorney Louis Franklin, who prosecuted Siegelman, and former HealthSouth CEO Richard Scrushy, said he was, quote, absolutely surprised by the court's ruling, but he added the government would continue to contest Siegelman's appeal. We lost this battle, but we'll still fight for the conviction. One has nothing to do with the other, just like his conviction has nothing to do with the law or the facts. Okay, so I added that last part, but it's true. So he will be released pending appeal. This is certainly not a victory. It is not a final victory, but it is a victory in one battle. It did follow on the heels of the House Judiciary Committee's announcement of plans to bring Siegelman to Washington. And somewhere along, and I assume that John Conyers was willing to force a showdown. U.S. Representative Arter Davis, a Birmingham Democrat who sits on the House Judiciary Committee, and if you recall him taking apart the fellow who, the guy from, the Federal Election Commission said that elderly African Americans aren't denied the right to vote because they generally die before they get to get elder. Yeah, he peeled that guy like a grape. Arter Davis said the panel's next step should be to summon former presidential advisor Karl Rove to testify. Woo-hoo! Yeah. And Karl Rove will, of course, then put his middle finger in the air, direct it toward the House Judiciary Committee, and say, come get me. Davis said if Karl Rove influenced that decision, that's a very, very, very serious thing. It is not ultimate victory, but it is a victory. And you take your victories where you can find them. So that's inspiring. And thanks to everybody who hustled the story into me, from our pal Cindy, to Monique, to Mark Levine himself, who stuck around and listened for a little while, which I find cool. Other stuff this evening. That has to be the news of the evening. That's got to be the piece of breaking news, with the greatest amount of gravity. But there are other things out there that are well worth the effort. While we run around and folks like our remedial listener Matt say things about, you know, we got to kill the Islamic terrorist. Reality is being dealt with. I like that sign, reality spoken here. Reality is being dealt with in places like the United Kingdom. The Associated Press reporting today, the British military admitted today that it breached the human rights of an Iraqi man who died in custody, and that its soldiers also violated the rights of 8 other detained Iraqis. Wow. If only we could find it in our national psyche to admit that we've done the same to about, a million Iraqis? Give or take a Haji. Yeah, a million. The Ministry of Defense said it expects to negotiate compensation for the... Jesus, isn't that just noxious? Now, you just heard that come out of my mouth, and didn't that just sort of make you throw up a little bit in the back of your throat? Do you realize that the mats of the world go around referring to Iraqis and Arabic peoples in general as Hajis and camel jockeys and ragheads and diaper heads, and that they're even taught to do that in boot camp? Really? To dehumanize the persons that they are taught to consider their enemy, even though that enemy never, ever, ever attacked the United States before George W. Bush began raining hell and damnation and death on them. Lo, these long, long, long 5 years ago. The UK Ministry of Defense said it expects to negotiate compensation for the survivors of the dead man, Baha Moussa, and with the 8 former detainees. Ministry of Defense admitted breaching prohibition on torture laws in the case of all 9 men. See, instead of doing this little dance about the United States does not torture, and then admitting, well, but we do things that the rest of the world considers torture, but it's not torture because we say it's not torture. See how it works? Moussa, Bahamusa, who at once upon a time was a 26-year-old hotel receptionist, died from asphyxia after soldiers restrained him following an escape attempt. Corporal Donald Payne, age 35, was convicted of inhumane treatment in that case, making him the first British soldier to plead guilty to a war crime under international law. You see, the international war crime law works. It just works. And the sun will rise on the United Kingdom tomorrow. The lights will go on. Traffic will roll through Trafalgar Square in London. And it'll just be another day on the sceptered isle. And nothing will come crashing to a halt. Gee, I remember when right-wingers said that for the United States to sign on to the International War Crimes Tribunal would cause us to lose our precious American way of life. And yet it doesn't appear to have done so in Great Britain. Armed Forces Minister Bob... I've got to get glasses. Ainsworth issued a written statement saying, "I deeply regret the actions of a very small number of troops, and I offer my sincere apologies and sympathy to the family of Bahamusa and the other 8 Iraqi detainees. All but a handful of the over 120,000 British troops who have served in Iraq have conducted themselves to the highest standards of behavior, displaying integrity and selfless commitment. But this does not excuse that during 2003 and 2004, a very small minority committed acts of abuse, and we condemn their actions." But see, in America, you can't condemn the actions of a torturing American soldier. No, no, no. Because that would mean that you hate the troops. That's how sad it's gotten in America. We have confused condemning human rights abuses with condemning our military, and they are not the same thing. They're not the same thing at all. So we'll continue to torture. We'll continue to slaughter. We will continue to murder. And we will do so with impunity. And we will do so with no justice whatsoever for either the victims or the perpetrators. The Ministry of Defense admitted a substantive breach of Article 2's right to life and 3, prohibition of torture, of the European Convention on Human Rights. It also admitted breaching the prohibition on torture in the cases of Mohammed Dahir Abdullah, Mohammed Amin Chalab Alwaz, Safar Shukri Abdullah, Joad Karim, Jamar Al-Fayez, Dahir Abdullah Ali Al-Mansouri, Radif Tahir Muslim Ahwan, Baha Hashim Muhammad, and Ahmed Taha Mosa. Quoting, "The Ministry of Defense further accepts that the admitted substantive breaches of the convention give rise to claims for compensation." Actually, it kind of sounds to me like it streamlines the process and makes justice more likely to happen than less likely to happen. But again, we can't be doing stuff like that here in America, in Bushmerica. Nope, Can't do that. So we'll take a little break, come back. Hey, light the phones up. Let's have a conversation. What do you say? 877-443-2036, toll free. If you want to save us a nickel or a buck, 304-658-3333. This is Conversation Radio. This is America's liberal voice. This is The Horn. A seven-nation army couldn't hold me back. They're gonna rip it off. Taking their time right behind my back. And I'm talking to myself at night because I can't forget.
Your second hour in the liberal sandbox, and you're head on with Bob Kincaid.
Thanks, B. Rez. Our buddy Marty writes in and says, "Don't forget, don't leave out sand." But I won't say that word. And yeah, Haji was the best friend of one Johnny Quest. That's right, Marty. And the dog was Bandit. Oh, dear me, I'm dating myself. Watched a lot of Johnny Quest in my day. And let's see, who was Dr. Quest's right-hand man? Rafe Bannon? Race Bannon? Correct me if I'm wrong. Didn't Johnny look a lot more like Race Bannon than he looked like Dr. Quest? Just saying. So, yeah. All right, let's roll along. Let's find some other stuff. And I don't have all night to spend on remedial right-wing chicken hawks. Because there's too much other stuff out there. Just in case you were wondering, after the bailout, the bailout you paid for the Bear Stearns hummingbird's tongue omelet crowd, with a little Veuve Clicquot on the side. Bloomberg News reports Wall Street banks, brokerages, and hedge funds may report $460 billion in credit losses from the collapse of the subprime mortgage market. In other words, that is almost four times the amount already disclosed. Who said that? Some raving lunatic with a sign that says the end is near, standing somewhere on Times Square. No. Goldman Sachs Group said that. Other analysts said profits will continue to wane. There is light at the end of the tunnel, but it is still rather dim, according to Goldman analysts in a note to investors on Tuesday. Earnings and share prices at U.S. financial institutions tumbled in the past year as fallout from the mortgage crisis spread to other markets. You know that. Demand for mortgage-backed securities evaporated, leading to the collapse of Bear Stearns, once that market's largest underwriter. But see, here's a journalism moment where we've got to have a little correction. Once the market's largest underwriter, comma, and a Federal Reserve-led bailout by J.P. Morgan Chase and Company earlier this month. No. And a wealthy welfare bailout funded by the people of the United States. See, it still gets under my skin. Look, Bear Stearns was the part of the iceberg that we could see. The stuff that rips the economic hole in our hull, we have no idea about yet. Thanks, George! Great job you did with the economy there with your compassionate conservatism and your Vulcans and whatnot. That's just beautiful. And that light at the end of the tunnel that's very dim? Don't worry, Goldman Sachs analyst Andrew Tilton. It's going to get considerably brighter as the train draws nearer. Damn fool. But that's what you get when you. Hey, good news from Afghanistan, everybody. I thought about the something I heard on Mark Levine's program last week when I saw this. You remember at the Take Back America conference, Mark interviewed a lady by the name of Julie. And I apologize to Julie because I don't recall her last name. But she's one of the higher ups in Code Pink. And Code Pink, if you don't know, is actively involved in trying to end military violence against women and girls all over the world, especially as perpetrated by the good, Christian, godly, upstanding United States of America. And one of the things that Julie said, she corrected Mark when Mark said that the Taliban in Afghanistan was hell on women. And she said, I've been to Afghanistan, and I can tell you that most Afghan women preferred the Taliban. And at the time, I kind of went, what? And then I see this story, and I can't help wondering, what the hell's the difference? What's the difference between the Taliban and the free young democracy of former UNICAL executive Hamid Karzai? Pick this up from the Feminist Peace Network. A recent editorial in the government-owned Kabul Times, the Kabul Times of Kabul, Afghanistan, offered a stark reminder of the widespread acceptance of violence against women in Afghanistan. The editorial, which ran 4 days after International Women's Day on March 8th, God, thy name is irony. The editorial, which ran 4 days after International Women's Day on March 8th, was titled, Lord, how I wish that... Let me check that. No, the address bar does not say The Onion. The editorial was titled, A Few Reasons for Violence Against Women. Now, this is the lead newspaper in Kabul, Afghanistan. The Free Afghani Press. The forward-looking, progressive, marching boldly into a free future press organ of the Hamid Karzai government. And the editor there is a guy named Abdul Haq. And it's an English language newspaper, and he is its editor-in-chief. And he wrote, 4 days after International Women's Day, we always condemn men who beat their wives or sisters, but overlook what some women do to invoke men's ire. To begin with, there are numerous obstinate, groggy, nagging, quarrelsome, stingy, and arguing women in this country who disturb the peace in their families. When they get charged, they go on and on until they provoke their husbands to beat them black and blue. No, really, it really says that. FeministPeaceNetwork.org. It's like that really hateful old joke, that one-liner about there, out there about what's the problem with most abused women today? They just don't know when to shut up! Well, Abdul Haq apparently heard that sick little joke once and applied it to his own culture and found it to be entirely applicable. Acting editor S. Ghiasi told Al Jazeera that Abdul Haq could not comment on the issue because he was ill and hospitalized. Yeah, I bet his obstinate, groggy, nagging, quarrelsome, stingy, arguing wife read and put him in the hospital. The folks at Feminist Peace Network add, unfortunately, that attitude is all too indicative of the reality of women's lives in Afghanistan, and the violence that is perpetrated against women has nothing to do with how they conduct their lives. Rather, its cause lies in deep-rooted misogyny that continues despite the so-called liberation of Afghan women. A UNIFEM study based on primary database of violence covering 21 districts over a year and a half, during which 1,011 cases were registered, found that most of the cases of violence were a result of forced marriages. Not because the wives are mouthy, but because they were forced into marriages in which they did not wish to be. See, the right to choose has a lot more to do with stuff besides abortion. The report also stated that the incidence of forced marriages is as high as 70 to 80%, while 57% of marriages are estimated to be engaged in before the legal age of 16. 57% of marriages are compelled upon girls, young girls. Afghanistan also suffers one of the world's highest maternal mortality rates. One woman dies every 29 minutes during childbirth, and a female literacy rate that stands at 15.8%, nearly half that of men. But the thing is, that's A-OK. Somebody send Laura Bush over to set Mr. Abdul-Haq straight just as soon as his bones start knitting back together again. In Afghanistan, a woman is perceived as an it rather than a she. There is no protection. Currently, Afghanistan has only short-stay provisions for emergency cases, most of which don't allow women to keep their children. If she leaves home and returns, she may be killed, in many instances legally. In the emerging democracy of Afghanistan, it's romantic, this fight for freedom. If I was a younger man and wasn't employed the way I am, I think I'd be over here. I'd want to be involved in this romantic fight. It's romantic fighting to establish a country where women can be beat black and blue for having an opinion. Oh, God, it makes me wistful for the good old days in America. Your tax dollars at work, friends. Your tax dollars at work. Hi, who have I got?
Hey, Bob, it's Scott from Salem. How you doing?
Hey, Scott, how are you, buddy?
Good, good. How you been?
Pretty good, pretty good.
So what are we on about tonight?
I've taken care of a remedial right-winger who tried to post on our blog and, you know, pointing out the joys of womanhood in Afghanistan and the good news that Don Siegelman's out on bond.
That last thing you just read is pretty disturbing. Just shows that where fundamentalism will take you,
It does, and tribalism. And all the isms of humanity of the 9th century B.C.
It's funny, though. I mean, it's not too long ago in this country that we had a pretty similar view. You know, we like to say that that we're the leader and the beacon for freedom and all that. And I can't do George Bush as well as you do, but it wasn't that long ago that
no.
We didn't even vote. Right.
And in fact, when West Virginia first became a state, and of course this has to be my benchmark reference, when we broke away from Virginia, it was necessary for us to pass something called a Married Women's Property Act. Because the oldie Dominion didn't have one, and we needed to establish the fact in 1865 or 1870 that married women could actually own their own property. You know, whether it was a sewing machine or a churn or a milk cow or a pistol. It had to legally be declared that a woman could own property after she was married.
My understanding of the history for that was that what ended up happening was that women would get married and the property would be joint. No, it wouldn't be joint. It wouldn't be theirs. It would be the husband.
Yeah, it would. It would transfer as well as she, the whole lot as chattel to the new husband.
But then when he died, and this had, I think this had a lot to do with men who owned a lot of land. When they died, the status of their heirs was still unknown, well, uncertain. The wife had a very special place because she could stay on the land, right, as long as she was still the mother of the heirs of the children. And what ended up happening, I think, was that you had creditors of the man who couldn't get at his property unless they could assign that property to the wife, and then they could sue her and get it from her and kick her off the farm.
Oh, beautiful.
And that's my understanding of the reason why they gave women property rights is so that there was a formal way of taking the property from them. You know, it wasn't women. Women didn't come up with this idea like, yeah, let's do this. You know, it's like
no,
creditors, banks came up with this. This is a problem for us. We've got to find a way of repossessing this farm, and we can't do it unless you change the rules for the property transferring from him to her so we can take it from her.
You know, you remind me of the story of a lady that I read about in Jeff Bigger's book, The United States of Appalachia, a lady by the name of Ann Royal. She was, in essence, the first blogger. This is the woman who agitated with the President of the United States until he conceded and agreed to push for funding for the newfangled telegraph machine. And she married a very wealthy older gentleman in what is now Greenbrier County, West Virginia, and was thrown off the place when he died. And she spent the rest of her life trying to get her rights to his estate because she had no rights because she was female.
Yeah. That's not too far in our future, in our past, I mean. It's really...
And what I try to point out, Scott, is that it's also not too far in our future if the so-called right-to-life crowd gets their way, because the last thing they're concerned about is babies. They're concerned with controlling women.
Yeah. Well, I think this is the problem with, this is one of the many problems with fundamentalism, right? It allows you to characterize somebody else as not a person, right? So if you believe that everyone who's not a, whatever your fill in the blank with your religion, right? If you believe that everyone who's not an X is not a person, then it allows you to do these kinds of things, right? It allows you to build these categories in your mind that actually make it okay for you to, say, take other people and own them as property, right? Or, for example, if you believe in the ideology, if you're a fundamentalist, sort of right-wing, sort of economist-type person, then you can view labor as though it's a commodity.
You can do the Milton Friedman job on it.
Exactly. You can say, you know, it doesn't matter that these people don't have jobs anymore because, you know, the jobs went over to those people over there, and people are fungible, right? And it makes it very easy to say, well, you know, that's, you know, you have that in an economy. You know, some people win, they're winners and they're losers, you know.
That was brought into stark contrast a few years ago when a mine company down the road from me went bankrupt, and it was a union mine, and there were union labor contracts in force, and the company went bankrupt. And the federal bankruptcy judge listed all of the pensions and the people who held them as not people with pensions, but as nothing more than liabilities to the company on its balance sheet,
right,
and erased those pensions with the stroke of a pen.
That's right. That's right. And that's, I mean, you know, how do you do that? What enables you to do that?
How do you go to sleep at night when you've done it, Scott?
Well, it's the ideology helps you, right? I mean,
I'm just following the law.
Yeah, you know, the law, the purpose of the law is to make sure that the economy can operate smoothly, and that's why we enforce contracts and we try to establish damages and so forth, right? And the fair thing for us to do in this case is to, you know, stack up the liabilities and the creditors get theirs first, and you get to the bottom, there's no money left. Well, I guess all the liabilities below this line on the balance sheet just don't get paid.
But they're so pathetic.
It doesn't matter that those are people.
No. Whether it's a rusty front end loader or a guy whose wife has breast cancer, same thing.
Right, exactly.
But the thing is, they so fundamentally miss it, because the whole purpose of the law, at least within the Anglo-Saxon tradition, is to prevent society from seeking its remedies by virtue of the edge of the sword. And having society descend into chaos with everybody chopping at everybody else.
Well, I think, I mean, another way of looking at it, maybe it's more cynical, is the law is recognition by the people in power that chopping people's heads off is very expensive. And actually, the judicial system's pretty cheap in comparison.
Yeah, and
as long as people think the system is fair, they'll actually abide by it, no matter how ridiculous the outcomes are. And you don't have revolutions like you used to, or maybe sometimes you ought to, right? because people have bought into this very system. And
well, look at the case I had last night of Debbie Shanks. That poor woman from Missouri. A semi-tractor trailer hit her. It wasn't her fault. Her health insurance through Walmart covered it. Then they settled out of court with the semi-tractor trailer's insurance, and Walmart came along and took away every penny that was set aside for her long-term care. And the Supreme Court refused cert on it on Monday.
See what I mean? I mean, I look at these things, you know. I mean, it's interesting to go back to law school as an adult, right? And you look at the system the way it is, and you ask, why? Who would want to make a system that works this way? Right? I mean, why is the system? I view the system as like you came down to the planet from some other planet, right?
Yeah.
And you say, look at this system. Huh. I wonder, and then you look and you see a system where some people do dramatically better than others. And you go, gee, I wonder if the system is the way it is in order that some people can do dramatically better than others. If that's the purpose of the system's being maintained for that very purpose. You know, I think corporate law is actually a good example of that. The way that corporate law works is a great example of a set of laws that are set up so that people can basically enrich themselves. And, you know, it's not really a question of fairness. Anytime the court gets to a place where it says, well, you know, all these people got laid off, you know, of course, none of the people in the upper hierarchies of the company are going to get laid off. They're all going to spend most of their time voting themselves raises. But none of that's actually illegal. Because, you know, the market's a fickle place, and they're really just doing what's best in the interest of the shareholders, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
and
yeah.
They can always fall behind that. Any decision, and basically the court looks at the decision and says, is it in the best interest of the shareholders? And then the court says, well, you know what? We're not business people. How would we know what's in the best interest of the shareholders? So they say,
we have to defer.
We have to defer. The board of directors must act in the best interest of the shareholders. How do we know what that is? We know what it is because it's what the board of directors does. Whatever the board of directors does, it must be in the interest of the shareholders.
Yeah, a circular self-proving logic that couldn't get you out of freshman philosophy 101.
But you know who it works for? If you're on the
board of directors.
Exactly, right? Nice little system we set up there.
Great work if you can get it.
Yeah, it's an inside job, you know. You've been talking about the Bear Stearns thing for the last couple of times we've tuned in. And, you know,
yeah, it still burns me up because I got a sneaking suspicion there's no Bear Stearns executives in the soup line in New York.
Well, yeah, I'm sure that's true. But I think one of the things that I thought was really annoying as that whole story broke was, you know, you're listening to the news outlets, you know, and you're listening to, you know, national public radio or whatever, right? You're listening to even, you know, stuff on television. And they put some expert up there, some economist, you know, say, now tell us why they did this bailout. And I said, well, you know, this was really important move by the Fed. The market's very, very concerned about, you know, the unraveling of all these derivatives and so forth, you know, basically being the thread that pulls the whole thing apart. And it was really, really wise move for them to get in really aggressively, et cetera, et cetera. Right? And then the person from, say, the BBC or somebody will say, so do you think then that these investment banks should be regulated in order that they don't overextend themselves like this in the same way that regular banks are regulated?
Oh, no.
Oh, no. You know, when the government gets involved, that's always a bad thing.
Except the government just got involved.
Except in the previous sentence, the government was giving you $12 billion. Right? You said that was a terrific idea. I just love that kind of hate.
But you go up and down the road, you listen to the news, you look at the paper, you see the stuff on TV. Is it just me, Scott, or did I miss it? I mean, is anybody marching in front of the Bear Stearns building?
Well, you know, I don't know. I think people are actually scared, right? I mean, people they've heard so much about how tenuous the economy is, they don't really know what to do. And I'll put a little bit of different spin on the ball. I think that as progressives, we should remember that what the Fed did is exactly the kind of thing that the Fed didn't do before the Depression. And it's a, exactly the kind of thing that the Roosevelt administration set up, the sort of, New Deal economy. They set the New Deal economy up for the government to act as a flywheel and a buffer for the kind of overextension and greed that unbridled capitalism is going to give you, right? I mean, this is exactly what these guys did. They overextended themselves.
Well, the fact, you're absolutely right, Scott. The response by the Fed was actually, truth be told, I mean, if you're looking at a whole spectrum sort of a view, it was a progressive response to the situation.
Yeah.
The problem, however, is that we don't get to have the progressive response to the situation on the other end.
Oh, of course not. No. I mean, that's the whole thing, right? This is. I see them as equivalent, right? I think that in a situation like this, basically what we're all doing with our taxes is we're buying insurance, right? We're throwing some extra money in the kitty to make sure that if a bank is about to go down and that's going to cause a whole people to run on the bank and maybe pull the economics of the whole community out of whack, right? We can pay into that and make that not happen, right? Heaven forbid we should pay into another fund to help people who are out of work and need help feeding their kids. You know, we can't have that kind of welfare. We can't have the kind of insurance policy, right, where when people fall off the bottom because they've lost their job, you can't have a training program and some assistance to help them get back on their feet.
No, because that's a government social program.
Exactly. I view them as equivalent, right? I think it makes
I do too.
A good investment. It's a good investment to not let people slip off the end into poverty, but to give them the chance to return to being productive and being able to take care of their families. And it's also a good thing to throw some money in the kitty for the inevitable time when a bunch of people in the kind of suits that I have to put on when I go to work get greedy and overextend themselves.
Don't kid yourself. They've got better suits.
That's
no offense,
true. That's totally true.
They fly to London to Savile Row to have those suits made.
I can't bring myself to go into the stores where they buy their clothes. That's true.
That's just
like an ethical thing. But I do think it's true. I think it goes back to what we seem to talk about this a lot. Basic greed, right? I mean, what's caused this thing? What's caused this is that these guys overextended themselves. And, truth be told, they knew they were overextending themselves. Because when they made these, I mean, this is one of the interesting things about working where I do, right? Working at a big law firm, you actually get to see this from the inside.
Mm-hmm.
And it's pretty, it's kind of gross at times.
Well, it's the kind of thing that makes you come home at the end of the day and shake your head and feel like there's marbles inside.
Yeah, well, it's the kind of thing that makes you say, I got to call Bob. I got to talk to someone who can actually have a conversation with about this, So you've got all these kids, right? You have young guys, all these analysts, right, who are bundling these financial things together. And what they're doing is they're making derivatives, which are basically like mutual funds that bank on the future value of something. So they're buying futures.
Mm-hmm.
And these analysts, right, I mean, these are the people that are supposed to actually have been trained in this, basically say the following thing. My assumption is that this market, whatever the market is, and this time it was housing, is not going to fluctuate like every other market does, where sometimes it's up and sometimes it's down. It's going to go up inexorably, right? Now, everything you learn in business school and in economics tells you that that's just not true.
No, right? Not even a little bit.
Even if it's generally going up, it still fluctuates. It balances your good days and your bad days. Even when the stock market's going up, it's going up and down, right?
Yeah, that's why the Dow Jones thing every day, if you go to someplace like MarketWatch, looks like a crack addict's EKG.
Exactly, right? That's the most salient feature of it. Is that it's going up and down like crazy, right? But these guys ignore that. They buy themselves a little mortgage, right? And they say, this is going to be okay because we don't really need to put that much collateral to back this up because, house prices are going up. And then they sell another mortgage, right? And they sell an even more absurd mortgage at a low interest rate without backing it by anything. and they give another person a low-interest variable rate loan without backing it with any collateral. Next thing you know, they've got billions of dollars out there backed by only one thing, which is the value of the house, right? And then two things happen. Interest rates go up and house prices come down. And these guys are wiped out, right? Someone defaults on their loan, and the person who gave them the money to loan comes back for the money, and it's just not there. Comes back to the bank. The bank doesn't have the money.
Haven't we been here before? I mean, isn't this just a slightly more sophisticated version of the 1920s craze for buying on the margin?
It's exactly the same thing.
And I mean, you talked about FDR and the regulations and the machinery put in place to keeping it from happening. Didn't we put machinery in place to stop the buying on margin craze?
Well, this is the one thing, you know, this is the way folks like me make their living, right? Whenever you do that, you create a new instrument, right? That's what you learn, right? You learn that if something's regulated, if a particular kind of security is regulated, then you just create another kind of security through a contract, right? So you and I go outside the market. We just decide to sell each other these things, right? We don't post it on the market and sell it to the, you know, mom and pop, you know, investor. We sell it between the banks.
But didn't we, Scott, have something happen, and I hate to run out and goon on Bill Clinton, but wasn't it during the Clinton administration that we deregulated banking in such a way that the guy with the hip flask in his pocket down on the corner who talks to his flashlight can sell securities now?
No, it's true. I mean, it's absolutely true, and I think that, you know, when we think about the Clinton administration, you know, I don't know if it's you who said this, he's the best Republican president we've ever had.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, they during the Clinton administration, an awful lot of that kind of thing was done. Right. Truth be told. Right. I think we're seeing the results of that. We're seeing, because there's no underpinning to it now. And, you know, I have to say, thank God that there's still a Fed, and the Fed still has any money in it.
Yeah, but what's the money, Scott?
Well, you know what the money is? It's our money, right?
Yeah, to be truthful, if you consider 10 and 20 and 30 year T-bills and stuff like that, it's my grandkids' money.
Yeah, well, it's the same way we do the war, right? I mean, we just borrow it.
Without ever worrying about paying it back.
Yeah, and I mean, that's the sad thing about it. I mean, you know, Linda says that, you know, like, where are we going as a country, right? If we don't have the kind of ethic that you, if, or if we have the kind of ethic that you can just do that, you can just borrow indefinitely at an interest rate that's increasing with time. I mean, it's not too hard to figure out what's going to happen.
Well, that's my next question. Isn't the housing subprime thing, you know, I hear all these euphemisms, bubble, crisis, you know, I prefer to use the word dodge. Isn't that just a microcosm of the macrocosm that is the entire economic philosophy of the Bush administration for the last 8 years?
Well, yeah, it goes even beyond that, too, right? It goes to, I hate to do this, right, but it goes to, like, the Powell memo, right? Did you read that on the air? Well, you should definitely get that and read it on the air sometimes.
No, I read it myself and just talked about it in general.
It's hair-raising. But it's the, I mean, it goes...
He was like some sort of right-wing Nostradamus, wasn't he?
It sure was, right? I mean, it goes to this concept that the thing that amazes me is that people were taking out variable rate home equity loans to buy stuff. Right? Used to be you took out a home equity loan to make an improvement on your house. Right? You're going to add an extra room.
Because you're going to add to the home's equity.
Value.
Sure.
Right? You're going to make the home more valuable. People were for years being convinced that, you know, because housing prices are rising, you've got all that equity. They were taking it out and purchasing things with it, right?
Boat, car, truck, hot
exactly.
Tub, widescreen TV.
Yep. I mean, you know, some of the people were sending their kids to school and doing a lot of other kinds of things, sure, right? But that
happened, Scott, because of the attack on stuff like Pell Grants and Stafford loans.
Yeah. Well, it also happened because of just the absurd rise in the cost of college education.
Yeah.
Right? But if you know, it's amazing to me that this country is in hock up to its eyeballs. I mean, some ridiculous percentage, like 75% of people in this country have more than $10,000 of credit card debt. Not debt. No. Credit card debt.
Well, and that's precisely why you get the bankruptcy. What was it? It was the bankruptcy. No, it wasn't a revision. It wasn't an update. I remember my Senator Robert Byrd was four square behind it.
Oh, this is the bankruptcy reform.
Yeah, reform. There we go. There's that word I despise.
Yeah. Reform means that somebody was.
Because I mean, anybody. You've sat through a class on negotiable instruments and stuff like that, and bankruptcy and so forth. And you know, before we got ourselves all reformed, credit card debt just went down went down the swirling hole.
Yeah.
In a bankruptcy, but not anymore. Oh no. That was unsecured debt, and by that we mean, of course, debt that's not secured by what it was purchased with.
By any collateral.
Any kind of collateral, house, car, boat, whatever.
Yep.
It was unsecured debt, and it was a risk that the credit card companies took based upon a credit score and an attempt to extrapolate your ability to pay into the future. And they took the risk, and you took the risk, and it was an arm's length transaction, and sometimes it went kerflop.
Yeah.
But now it was transformed through the magic of Congress into the strangest of Frankenstein financial monsters, an unsecured secured debt.
Well, a government-backed unsecured loan.
Yeah.
Right? What does that mean? You know what that means. I mean, it means basically...
That means it's your butt.
It's because... But you listen to the rhetoric for it, right? Credit has to be easily available in order for the economy to continue to expand, and for consumers to continue to have the confidence that they'll be able to borrow.
But that's all well and good, but when the credit's being extended at 23.9% APR, what's the difference between that and the guy down at the bar?
Well, I mean, it's as an economic policy that you're going to grow the economy by making it easier for people to borrow money to buy things, that something's not right there, right? If you want to say, we're going to grow the economy by getting people better jobs so they get paid more, so they have more money to buy things. Okay, I'm with you there. That makes sense, right? Or we're going to grow the economy by trying to keep the price of things from inflating too much. You know, okay, that's good, right? But our economic strategy is to make it easier for people to borrow so that they can buy more stuff so that the economy can grow. It's just insane, you know.
Let's go around the corner to a different one. You say so the economy can grow. Whose economy? I mean, what's it growing on? The guy who uses the credit card to run over to Wally World and buy a TV that's made in China.
Mm-hmm.
Whose economy's getting grown?
Well, you know the answer to that, right? I mean, we get the answer to that every year after Christmas. They tell us how the Christmas shopping season was, and who do they pull? They pull Walmart. They pull all the big department stores. Right, that's the economy. It's nuts, but that's exactly right.
You know, so we've got a credit card based economy that is predicated on buying stuff we don't need.
That's yes, have to say.
Okay, then tell me what the difference is between that and the Dutch tulip omania between 1643 and 1646.
Tulips are pretty.
Tulips come back.
Yeah. I mean, because this has been disturbing me for a long time. You know, because this concept that growth comes only in the form of economic growth. Okay, I could even go there, depending on what your definition of economics is. But if the only kind of economic growth is consumer growth, I have a real problem with that. And here's let me give you a sort of a personal anecdote, which I think that many of your listeners will understand and appreciate. So Linda and I, for the first time, we've lived here for, I think, 12 years. For the first time, we went hiking in this little place in Salem called Salem Woods. And this place, Bob, it's just beautiful. It's like nobody knows it's there. And it's gorgeous. It's got the marsh and the meadow and the swans and the whole thing, right? And you got all the moss-covered rocks and the beautiful trees.
And you walk in and go, wow!
You go, wow, right? And Salem Woods is owned by the city, And Salem Woods is part of a larger parcel of land that includes the Salem Municipal Golf Course, which the city runs for revenue. So I can, you can almost guess.
I don't like where this is going.
So every couple of years, you know, there's something that says, you know, if we could expand the golf course, we could raise revenues, and we either wouldn't have to raise your taxes, or we could lower your taxes, right? Now, all I can tell you is when we were out there, we were hiking a couple weeks ago for a couple of hours, and, you know, it started snowing on us, you know, nobody else out there. You know, you go down into the sort of stream beds, and there's water running, you know, sort of spring water running, and you go up on top, and you see the stuff that's still burnt out from the winter wind. And I thought to myself, you know what? I'm wealthier than I was 2 hours ago.
Exactly.
I'm a wealthier man now. And if they take this from me, I will have had some of my wealth destroyed, right? Some of my economic value. If you have to stamp the word economic on it in order to make people understand it, then let me tell you, that is wealth also. And, you know,
it's the wealth of the commons.
It is. And it's something that, exactly, it's wealth that everyone shares, right? It's our national wealth. And what we do is we spend so much time listening to these people in January tell us how Walmart did during the holiday season that we never say, oh, and at the same time, we blew the tops off of 25 mountains, we filled 4,000 streams, we extended, you know, 7,200 golf courses into formally open space, you know, formally commonly used open space, et cetera, et cetera. So, yeah. You know, Walmart posted a 4.3% increase in revenues. And in other wealth news, public lands decreased by 7%. You know, water quality across the country decreased by 7%, et cetera. Tick the whole things off, right? Here's how your wealth balance sheet is doing. There's Walmart on the one side, and here's everything else on the other side. So it's just, you know, it seems to me like, and that, this is when you turn into a nut, right? This is when next time this thing comes up on the agenda, and they want to do this again, and you know it's going to come up, right? How are we going to get revenues up? And someone says, hey, you know what we ought to do? We ought to expand the golf course. And you fill your blank in. You fill the blank in with whatever insane
sure.
idea someone's going to have, right? And people like me are going to go there and say, you're destroying my wealth, you know? I mean, if we don't start doing that.
It's compounded wealth because it's wealth that continues into the future. And you're right. You have to do that.
That's the wealth of your grandchildren and your great-grandchildren, too, right?
Yeah, exactly. And frankly, whoever it is that's sitting on the city council has no right to take wealth. I mean, here's your right to life, Scott. No, if you're sitting on the city council, you ought not, or in the Congress for that matter, you ought not be able to indebt the unborn.
Yeah.
Which is what we've done with the occupation of Iraq, which is what we've done with all the deficit spending that we have done for a variety of reasons. You know, I go back, I get lost in these great big numbers. But, you know, when I think about George Bush running through, what, $7 trillion in 4 months? Because that's essentially what he did at the beginning of his presidency. We had a projected surplus that could have solidified Social Security, you know, for 100 years. Mm-hmm. And he ran through it like a drunk in a whorehouse.
Yeah, yeah.
And it astonishes me. My hometown down in Alabama, talking about golf courses, I grew up playing on one, and it was a beautiful thing down on the river bottom, and because it tends to flood, all the greens were up on, like, imitation Indian mounds. Now, I mean, granted, there were no windmills or clowns to put the ball through or anything. But it was a gorgeous, challenging course. Well, they closed that. About 10 years ago, they got this idea that they wanted to make a new golf course, and then they just realized that it's kind of like building two lakes and realizing you can't fill one without draining the one that already exists.
Uh-huh.
And so they opened the new golf course, which is this windy, open expanse of nothing with little scrub trees between the
yeah.
holes and so forth,
yeah.
where this other one had these huge stands of beautiful old white pines. Just a nice course. And so the golf course I grew up playing on is gone now because they wanted to take some land outside the city limits and put a new one in. And so it's not even a net gain, it's a net loss. But we got a new golf course. And there's no sense in it.
Yeah, I'm starting to think about this wealth thing more. You know, I think that you know, people have to find, they have to find wealth in things that are not consumerism, right? They actually have to think that those things are valuable enough that they get as pissed off when people take them from them as people do when they say, you know what, if we don't expand the golf course, you're going to have to raise your taxes by 50 cents. You know, I mean, that's really what it comes down to.
Yeah, raise them a buck.
It's raise them a buck, right? It's like, and people are like, you can't raise my taxes. If you know, if you raise them a dollar, you know, what? If you raise them a dollar, what? You won't be able to buy what exactly?
Because right? Dollars don't buy much anymore. No, they don't.
Yeah, it's just that.
We talk about the commons well. Like this and the things that make us poorer. And things that happened 10 or 15 years ago that are worth remembering. Well, golly Moses, what's one thing that most of us never think about that got basically taken from us in terms of the commons? The common airspace above our heads that carry radio and television signals.
Uh-huh.
The deregulation of media ownership. That was an out-and-out stealing from the people. Because, you know, the airwaves don't exist as an enrichment scheme for Rupert Murdoch.
Right. It's the property of somebody, yeah.
It is the property of the American people. And that's why an FCC exists. But, poof, gone. And we talk about re-implementing media ownership rules and doing some divestiture, and then the right wing screams, commies!
Exactly. Yeah. Well, it's kind of amazing now looking back on the Bush administration. And just saying, you know, do these guys have to do this every single time? And this was actually probably, it's the worst in my memory, because it was the first time that the right wing owned all four branches of government, including the media. And they just went to town. I mean, it was just, like you said, I mean, it was like raiding the bank, you know? It's unbelievable to see it. And then, you know, I hate to say it, but... You know, I almost, and I know you're going to tell me about Supreme Court justice, so I don't really mean this, but, you know, it's like, do we have to clean up this mess again? Right? I mean, the economy is going to be in bad shape, most likely, next year, when it's time for either Barack or Hillary to go into office, right?
I know. No, and you know what? I'm not going to say anything about the Supreme Court, because I understand this argument very, very well, and, Lottie from one of the moderators in our chat room mentioned something very similar during Mark Levine's program. He said, let it bottom out. Let it go. And let these SOBs deal with it on their own watch, and we won't have to worry about a Republican president or a Republican Congress for another 100 years.
Yeah. It's a hard thing to say, you know, because, you know, you and I had this talk before about, you know, yeah, but, you know, you've got these older Supreme Court justices and so forth. And I understand, I appreciate that argument, and I accept it. The only retort I'll give you from a sort of a constitutionalist perspective is the only reason that the Supreme Court is as important as it is today is because Congress is completely dysfunctional. Right? So you can't, the mountaintop removal is a perfectly good example, right? It'd be very easy, from a legal standpoint, to just make what they're doing illegal, to just change the law, the statute, so that it's no longer up to the agency to decide whether these things are or aren't pollution. Right? You just say they are and say they're illegal. But the only way you can do that is by passing a law through Congress. If you don't do that, then guess what? The administration gets to decide what it thinks those words mean. And when they decide that it means, yeah, you can put your stuff in the water, that's not pollution. And somebody says, well, wait a minute, you know, that stuff that you put in the water is poison, and sues them. Guess who figures out what the answer is? The Supreme Court or the judiciary.
Sure.
Right? The only reason the judiciary matters so much is because Congress can't say, look, that's pollution, knock it off. Right?
And, you know, you make me wonder, Scott, one of the primary focuses of the mountaintop removal opposition efforts these days is, and I can't remember the House bill number, but it's called the Clean Water Protection Act.
Right.
And it's a perfectly reasonable piece of legislation that's a response to, to mountaintop removal and all the so-called clarification that we've had over these tormented years.
Exactly, yep.
But you make me wonder if that isn't... if that isn't the means by which we let Congress dodge its responsibility. I mean, isn't it under the theory that you've just espoused, isn't it Congress's job to take a look at mountaintop removal and say, damn it, this is wrong. On behalf of the people of the United States, this is wrong. This has to end, and it will end as of the passage of this act.
That's absolutely a dodge, right? And this is why, this is the kind of stuff I studied administrative state, the guy who was doing environmental work. And it's exactly the reason why Congress makes the language in the statute so vague. Because they don't want to have to be pinned down as to what it means for political reasons. And then they push it off onto the executive. And they're hoping, of course, that there's going to be someone in the executive that actually takes a very pro-environment view, like you would expect the Environmental Protection Agency to pick vague language and interpret it in favor of protecting the environment, right? You might expect that. But you make the language vague, and you get a bunch of people like are in the administration now, and they say, oh, yeah, these vague words, you know what they mean? They mean you can put those rocks in those streams, no problem. Right, because rocks aren't pollution.
Right. It's just fill. It's not even fill. It's not even fill because that would invoke the buffer zone rule.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. So it's absolutely buck shifting. It's the fact that these guys,
aren't you highlighting the fact that somewhere along the way Congress has to want to be Congress again? I know that may sound like it's just too facile a statement, but you've spent a lot of time with your nose in the Constitution the last 3-4 years. Congress is not created in the first article of the Constitution for no reason.
Right.
I personally believe that the Congress was created to be the first among equals, and the executive and the judiciary comes third for a reason.
I think it's certainly true that. When people were setting up the government and thinking about what the government would actually do, how it would operate, they figured the Congress would be doing most of the work. Right? They'd make the laws. That would be where people would actually debate these things out.
Right, and the president's just there to execute them.
Yeah.
And the courts are there to clear up any misgivings.
Exactly. And to break up the fights that will be inevitably come out. Right? But they're not supposed to be actively interpreting these things. And believe me, strict literalism is a form of active interpretation.
Sure it is.
Right? So you're absolutely right. And what you've seen, that's the other thing you've seen over the last 8 years, right? You see the Congress is all Republican, and then it switches to Democrat, marginally Democratic control, and they can't get anything done. Right? They're deadlocked. And this is why, this is why I wonder what's going to happen with the next president, whoever that president is, right? I mean, I'm not so inclined to feel sorry for McCain if he becomes president, but, I mean, just imagine someone like either Hillary or Barack, how frustrated they're going to be. Because these people, especially Hillary, is very much a tactician, right? Here's the problem.
She's a manager.
Yeah, exactly. Here's a problem, and here's a four-step process for fixing it, right? And these guys go ballistic on step one. And filibusters and nuclear options and oh my god, right? And this is why I think it's kind of sad to be here listening to this healthcare debate between Barack and Hillary, because I have to say I'd be amazed if either one of those plans could get through Congress.
Well, and they're debating the difference between typhus and malaria when the cure is over there in the form of H.R. 676, but neither one can espouse H.R. 676 because the insurance industry will muscle up and squash either one of them who does it like a bug.
Exactly. I mean, this is what happened. This is why when I listened to Hillary's plan, I said, you know, remember what happened last time she said that exact thing? She was right before. I worked at Pfizer when Clinton 1 went through, and she was trying to do that. And within the walls of that place, there was no question that she was not going to win. Like, whatever it takes. You know, they spent, what, $480 million or whatever, right?
Yeah.
You know, and here I am, you know, I'm just fresh out of college, you know, I'm a research guy, I'm in the lab, you know, I'm trying to do my thing. And that place was just terrified by that proposition, by the proposition of nationalized health care. Even though, if they think about it, probably would have made them more money.
Well, yeah, that's the thing. I mean, I understand the insurance companies getting all bananas about it, Scott, but I never did get the pharmaceutical opposition, really. Because, you know, you've got all that universal health care, nationalized health care money being poured into the companies for research purposes. You've got a partnership between government and, you know, the government's not going to go into the pharmaceutical business.
No, absolutely not. And what they're going to do is they're going to tax people and give the money to the pharmaceutical companies. Right? I mean, that's, if you want to be just like, you know, just as harsh about it as you can. From a pharmaceutical company's perspective, you think, you know, right now, all we get is the money people make, right? But now we're actually going to get, like, a government subsidy, right? It's a huge amount of money. And then when they realized that with Medicare, actually, was when the light went on their head. They realized it was a lot of money to be made there, so they came up with sort of a special deal for that. But they didn't want to sort of have that affect the broader market. You know they're going to do it again, though, right? These guys, like insurance. Actually, you know what's interesting is the drug companies have lost a lot of their bargaining power to the insurance companies, because the insurance companies buy in bulk and they buy under contract, and the insurance companies are tough.
Yeah.
So if I'm a pharmaceutical company, I might even want to consider whether I wouldn't rather get paid by the government.
Well, I mean, insurance companies buy in bulk, but they can't buy in the bulk that the federal government does.
That's true, and they can't. But they can't make the kind of unilateral decisions that the federal.
And under a universal health care system, Scott, tell me if I'm wrong. There's no need for these monumental advertising budgets.
Well, you know, I think if you look at either one of their plans, they're still market based, right?
Well, yeah.
So there's still going to be a market out there for these guys to sell into, for people who don't want to have the national plan or who want to supplement it. So I'd be surprised, right? I mean, and that's why it's not really socialized medicine. It's not socialized medicine at all. It's basically just providing a plan, a government-backed plan, for people who want to pay that instead of, or for people who are not in a position because of their employment or whatever, to buy it privately. And then I don't know, for example, you know, if you had a small business and you had, say, 50 employees, you know, you could, I guess, say, we don't have health care. You can get it from the government, right? And pay some tax for that and pay into the government plan.
When's American business going to wise up, Scott? Because, when's Detroit going to wise up?
Yeah.
When are they going to realize that they come out ahead of the game by supporting universal health care? Because that's where they're, I mean, isn't it true that that's where they're getting their butts kicked?
Well, I don't know. Yeah, what I don't know is, it's again, I always love to look at foreign countries, right, and say, and ask myself, you know, how do the Japanese car companies do it? Do they really not provide their people with health care? Do they just rely on the national system? And if they do, the national system must be reasonably good. How do they do that? Right. I mean, the presupposition here is that the national system's going to stink, and so, you know, employers won't want to offer it because no one will want to work for them. Right. And I just don't believe that that has to be true. I think it would be just like when industries fought for workman's comp. Right. I mean,
the original tort reform.
Yeah, exactly. Workers didn't get workman's comp. Employers got workman's comp, right? They're the ones who pushed it through, because they're like, yeah, it's just too hard to predict whether I'm going to get creamed by some tort because I let some guy get his arm chopped off, right? And so they said, well, here's what we'll do. We'll pay into insurance, a government insurance plan, and if one of the workers gets hurt, you take care of them, right? Or we take care of them together. Why they haven't figured out that the same thing applies to health care when those prices are going up 10% a year.
Oh, but Scott, consider your example there, workers' compensation. What you had, you know, all this happens, you know, what, around the 1880s, well, 1890s, 1900s, 1910.
Yep.
And you've got individual state governments setting up workers' compensation funds.
That's right. Yeah, that's right.
And they were, you know, long before there was ever an FDR, they were a form of, risk spreading.
Well, that's mostly what the unions did early on, too, right?
Yeah.
Union dues was basically accidental death and dismemberment insurance.
And so what you get out of the workers' comp situation is that you cruise along for a while, and then the private sector says, wait a minute, we're missing out on a bunch of wealth.
Yeah.
And they start howling that, your workers' compensation system's not adequately funded, and you live in a judicial hell hole, and, you know, all that garbage, until you wind up taking a workers' compensation system that wasn't broken, and you privatize it. And see, I've got West Virginia as a direct example of this, because up until, 4 years ago, we had all along a state-administered workers' compensation plan.
Uh-huh.
And it had worked like clockwork up until a man named Arch Moore became governor. He was, of course, a Republican. Who saw the workers' compensation plan as a means by which he could reward his cronies. And so he forgave a lot of back debt from people like coal companies that have this habit of sort of, you know, playing out the mine and moving along and, you know,
right.
Never mind that, you know, old debt. And, well, Arch wound up going to prison. But he deliberately put the workers' compensation plan behind the eight ball, such that by the time you get to 2004, there is, by virtue of a couple of other legal maneuvers and something called a second injury fund, which let employers off the hook, you've got a workers' compensation system that's in to a certain degree of financial crisis.
Mm-hmm.
Along comes our governor, a Democrat, theoretically, named Joe Manchin, who says, well, the answer to this is to privatize it.
Okay.
So they create this sham corporation called Brick Street Insurance, more like Brick Through the Window Insurance, and privatized workers' compensation. Brick Street spends a fortune on a brand new building on the most choice real estate in the city of Charleston, you know, four stories and the better part of a half a block long, half a block square even. And a guy who had been a Manchin crony in workers' compensation suddenly gets elevated to CEO, and his salary goes through the roof. And now people who had workers' comp through the state are looking up and saying, wait a minute, you promised us lower premiums. My premiums are higher.
Mm-hmm.
And they're higher and going higher. Because suddenly now it's a private company, and they've got shareholders to satisfy, Scott.
Right.
And they've got executive salary, and we've got to be competitive in the insurance business, or we can't draw the best and the brightest.
Yeah. There's that greed thing again.
Yeah.
Because they've got greedy shareholders.
And so, yeah, I mean, we do. While I am four square and absolutely unmovable on the idea of universal health care, I also recognize that we're going to have to pay, if we're ever going to have it, we're going to have to pay very, very close attention to it.
Mm-hmm.
Because, well, I mean, I learned, I mentioned it a few weeks ago, it turns out the fundamentalists in this state have gotten their hands on Medicaid in West Virginia.
How so?
With regard to contraception.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, because again, you know, sort of coming full circle to some of the origins of our conversation, it's not about babies, it's about controlling women. And it's not just about controlling their reproductive parts, it's about controlling their minds and all of their bodies, too.
Yeah.
So you've got a situation where a young woman has children and decides, and you know, it's not unusual to have happen in this state, that a young woman under 21 would be ready to not have any more babies for the rest of her life. And nope, sorry, we can't do that. We won't do that. You can't have your tubes tied.
Wow.
Medicaid won't pay for it, but we will pay for you to have another baby.
Sure, sure.
And that's strictly and exclusively a function of fundamentalism in government.
Yeah, well, that's the other. That's, you're right. I mean, it's so you know you wish this thing, right? You say, well, it'd be great if we could have national health care, right, or universal health care. And then you think, well, wait a minute now, you know.
Well, I mean, I still want it, but I only want it if it. I want it, and I want to jealously guard it from day one.
Yeah, it's just it's hard. I know you don't. I'm just assuming you don't watch American Idol, but we have these friends who are just hilarious about that show. And they say, you know, American Idol is basically like a microcosm for American democracy, right? And anyone who watches the show will know this scenario, right? They get down to whatever the selection round is. And, you know, they'll have this bunch of people if there's nine left or there's ten left or whatever. And the host goes up there and says, and America has voted. And our friends say, that's the most terrifying words you're ever going to hear, because you know something really asinine is about to happen, right? It's just become a joke with me and Linda now. You know, it's like, and America has voted, and guess what they voted for, you know?
America has spoken. I'm the president.
Exactly. It's like, oh, good Lord, you know? It's scary. America has voted, and you know, and guess what? We've got nine extra holes at the golf course. You know? Didn't our wealth just go up? Aren't we all a wealthier nation than we were before?
Not hardly.
Not hardly.
And
hey, on a completely different topic, before I'm going to let you go.
Okay.
I got Comarcade.
Yeah.
You asked me whether I was a Nightfly fan or like Comarcade as well, and I haven't had the chance to listen to it yet. But I'll tell you, it's like one of those things where I've oscillated in terms of my thoughts about Nightfly over the years as to whether it was like just the poppiest, twinkiest album ever, or whether it's just a complete masterpiece.
See, I camped out on masterpiece and have never moved.
Yeah, well, you got to admit though.
Oh yeah, it's designed to be that way because it's a concept album.
It's boy, is it boppy though? I mean, it's just
But I don't know if it still comes on the. Yeah, I think it's on the liner notes of the CD too. But there's a blurb in it about where the album is supposed to be coming from.
Yeah, yeah. And
it's like a 12-year-old boy listening to the radio in the late 50s.
Yeah.
And of course, you know, the Nightfly is just... anybody who's ever worked a midnight shift at a radio station has lived that lyric.
Yeah, yeah. No, I love that lyric about, you know, you say there's a race of men in the trees, you're for tough legislation. I love that. Because that's so you know, it's so typical.
And the line that comes after it, I wait all night for calls like this.
Yeah, exactly. Of course, that song turns out to be a love song, right?
Which, yeah.
And it's got some of the most awesome chord changes, piano chord changes that come immediately after that. And then immediately after that comes some of the most sniveling guitar solo you're ever going to hear, right? Just classic Steely Dan, right? That like really kind of greasy, sleazy kind of guitar solo, you know? And you listen to it, you're like, God, that's good. You know, that's really good. So the new album, I downloaded it. I didn't actually buy it. Yeah.
I've got all three here. I've got Kamakiriad and Morph the Cat.
Kamakiriad, is that how it's pronounced?
Yeah.
Okay, Kamakiriad.
It too is a concept album, and it's about his trip in his new car, which is called a Kamakiri.
Okay.
And he tells you all about it in the first track, Trans Island Skyway.
Yeah,
and it's a very green automobile.
Yeah,
it's a Kamakiri, and this is the Iliad of him in his Kamakiri.
Oh, okay, that's cool. That's fun.
Morph the Cat is very. I don't know. It's got a very sort of New York flavor to it. It's got a sort of, you know, five stories up, and you can still hear the honking horns on the street below. Uh-huh. Sort of a very. It's the Steely Dan guys. I mean, you know, the Donald Fagen. It's going to have a jazzy quality.
Kind of that jazz funk kind of thing, yeah.
Yeah, and it's got a kind of a an old school sort of, you know, atonal spoons on pavement jazz quality to it.
Oh, fun, yeah, yeah.
And it's it's a dandy. So I tell you what, just for you and Linda, I'll fire up a chunk of Morph the Cat when we get done here, just to sort of segue into the last segment of the program.
Awesome. Well, that's, you know, I'm looking forward to, you know, starting the thing on song one, putting it under the headphones, and like just, you know, listening to the whole thing and getting in the mood.
And yeah, I go back and forth. I waffle as when I've got a new album. I always waffle on whether to sit there with the lyric sheet first.
Yeah.
Or just to let it happen to me first.
Yeah.
And the lyric, Kamakiriad, the lyrics are wonderful. It's nothing like the concept behind the Nightfly. It's very futuristic.
Yeah.
Tomorrow's Girls is a very poppy kind of thing. And, you know, great sci-fi kind of lyrics because it's set in the future. Tea House on the Tracks is gorgeous.
This is one of the problems. I mean, as much as I enjoy the concept of downloading music, which I pay for, by the way, as much as I enjoy that concept, but the one thing I miss, and I even miss this from the CD era, is the ability to hold the album and listen.
Absolutely.
You know? Actually, it's just like hold it between your hands at a sort of a human scale between your hands and read it.
Oh, it was a tactile experience, especially with vinyl, because of all the beautiful, beautiful work that went into the art behind those things.
Yeah.
That one art design house, Hypnosis, just, you know, whether they were doing the Man on Fire shaking hands with Pink Floyd's Wish You Were Here, or the cover of an Alan Parsons album, or I think they did some of the Steely Dan albums. I think Hypnosis also did the Al Stewart Year of the Cat cover. You know, just beautiful detailed art, and it's. I think album art was to the 60s and the 70s what Varga's pinup art was to the 30s and 40s.
Yeah, that's a good one. I like that. It's true, because you'd sit there, I mean, you'd sit there with the thing playing, you know, you'd sit on the floor and you'd have the album out, you know, and you'd, if it was good, it was a double album, and it's all folded up. And it was
I spent hours with the cover to Pink Floyd's The Wall.
Uh-huh.
Sorting out all the trivia that, because you know, they used that album cover as a means of enhancing your auditory experience of the music.
Right.
And
right.
So you go into the down itty bitty fine print. I love this about the Wall cover, the full vinyl, and you find out that one of the backing vocals is Tony Tennille.
Yeah, that's right. They used to put all that on there.
Yeah, and then you have to go and find out where she is. And that you know, that blew me away, because Tony Tennille is the voice. I mean, you're familiar with The Wall, aren't you?
Sure. Yeah.
Okay. You know where Pink goes into his trailer there, and it's right before the crack up. And the groupie follows him in and goes, "Oh my God, are all these your guitars?"
Yeah.
And then you hear her go across the room, and she's further away the next time. She says, "You wanna take a bath?" Tony Tennille.
You're kidding. Oh, no. I guess that's the hazard of reading the fine print.
And, of course, the beauty of vinyl is it can also be played backwards.
What does Tony Tennille say when it's running backwards?
Well, no, when it's running backwards, the hidden message is, welcome to the hidden message. Send all responses to Old Pink, care of Funny Farm, and then some sort of English address. And it's a reference to Syd Barrett.
Oh, yeah.
Lord, I'm a geek.
Yeah, you are. That's a beautiful thing.
It is. And you can't get that experience out of a handful of electrons.
You know, what I've noticed is and this is a silly thing. You know how albums used to make this noise that sort of went like this, tick, tick.
Oh, yeah.
Tick, right? It happens at a certain pace, right? And now CDs make that noise where they go, na 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 na, right?
Right.
I think there's something to that, right? I mean, that's like modern day living, right? It's like everything's now digitized. It's like na 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 na. Listen to something on albums is so quaint, because it's just got, you know, it's got your fingerprint on it from the day you bought it and you accidentally touched, you know, you touched it. It's like.
John Fox last night for his track of the day played a tune from an Aussie band from 1970, And, you know, most of his tracks are digital, you know, MP3s, but this had been transferred from vinyl.
Yeah.
And Scott, I kid you not, the aural difference between it was like there was cold water running out of my speakers.
Because this
was one of the conversations I had with another audiophile not too long back. It bears remembering that the ear is also an analog device.
Yes.
It is, you know, we don't have digital ears.
There's actually an amazingly large portion of your brain dedicated to decoding sound.
Yeah.
I don't know that it's bigger than sight, but it's comparable. Because it's more, you know, it's more well-developed. And so you can do things with music that just, you know, with sound, forgetting even about music, just the sounds you can make and the ways you can make people feel with sound that are, you know, really incredible. That's what those, I'm a geek that way too. You know, we have some of these albums, some of the newer albums that are really pretty fun that are, you know, like remixes, like Cornelius Remix is a perfect example.
Mm-hmm.
The sound quality is just unbelievable. You know, it's just so good. Yeah, you know? I mean, there's something to be said for really well done digital recording as well. But
sure. But the first time I fell in love with the Nightfly was on a Virgin vinyl pressing of analog to digital to analog.
Yeah.
And it was back when, you know, if you were a real, real geek about it, you'd spend $35 on a piece of vinyl.
Yeah,
and it just and I listened to it. Wow, this is getting bad, Scott. You're taking me bad places. I listened to it on a pair of Stax electrostatic ear speakers.
Oh, well, I know exactly what you're talking about. They were enormous things, right? And had these like fins on the outside of them.
Yes.
Yeah. I know exactly what you're talking about.
But the thing is, you could hear the artist breathing.
Yeah.
And I went and priced those things not too long back, and yeah, I don't think because mine got stolen in college, of course.
Yeah, you need like a 150 watt amplifier to run them, right?
Well, no, they come with their own little amp box.
Do they? Okay.
Yeah, and it goes into for instance, if you had a receiver with an A and B speaker outputs on the back, these really heavy gauge wires that would plug, it would go into the, say, the B section of your speakers.
Of the speaker output.
Yeah, of the speaker outs, and then it would go through the box, and you just had a knob on the front for speakers and ear speakers. And, oh, my God, all of that power got delivered straight into those things.
Wow, that sounds like a...
I even had an email conversation with a guy in Japan about them, and apparently... It's audiophile stuff over there too,
yeah.
But they had a contract, and I guess every pair of headphones inside NHK is Stax.
Uh-huh.
And you know, I thought, hey, can I get in on that contract and get the reduced rate?
Uh-huh.
Because
I mean, they've got to be like $1,000 or $1,700.
Those are the cheap ones.
Yeah.
You can drop $8,000 on a pair of these things without even trying. You know, gold spattered and just, you know, you know, I don't know. It's like having a hooker for your ears or something.
Yeah. Well, that's the Elliot Spitzer edition of the.
Hard not to go there, isn't it?
Yeah, I just said sorry. I have to do that.
Yeah,
I gotta get some dinner in me.
All right. Well, bon appetit.
I just wanted to tell you. You know, we've been listening. I've been getting home so late from this stupid job.
Oh,
but
yeah.
I'm glad to have had the chance to call in. And
oh, I love these conversations. I wait all night for calls like these.
Hey, I'm for tough legislation.
Absolutely. Take care, Scott, and give
all
our
right,
best to Linda.
Later.
All right, bye now.
Bye now.
Our buddy Scott in Salem, Massachusetts. Oh, I love these wide-ranging conversations. So just for him and Linda from Morph the Cat, The Night Belongs to Mona. We'll be back right here on America's Liberal Voice, The Horn.
Only for badness, yeah. when she comes alive. Yes, the night belongs to mine. When she's dancing all alone, body flows above the city. CD spinning, AC humming, feeling pretty. Sometimes she'll call at some unholy hour. She wants to talk.
Tonight's final hour of Head On begins now. 1-877-4-HEAD-ON. That's 1-877-443-2366. Here's Buck.
Well, I'm hearing it's a tough night in the desert for my beloved Mountaineers. They've gone to the half down to Xavier. Hopefully that will be responded to much as they did going to the half down against Duke last week. Well, there's our college sports moment for the evening. You can now all return to listening to the program. And among other things, let's go back to the phones. Hi, who have I got?
Good evening, Bob.
How's it going, David?
Yeah, it's going all right. I haven't called in a little bit. When you're talking about Donald Fagan, I at least was under, I don't know if you've ever read the Real Steely Dan book.
No.
But there's a part in it where they talk about how they assembled the music and what they were into at the time. And I always thought that the lyrics, that wasn't just the satire, it was also the music as well. and the chord changes, because they would go on, and a lot of the people, they didn't interview the actual Sagan and Becker, but they would always harp on different chord changes that made something sound popular or something, and say, why can't you play something like Sonny Rollins or John Coltrane or Thelonious Monk? And I always thought that they did this as a joke, and then eventually they really got into making it kind of like...
I always thought East St. Louis Toodaloo was a joke.
What is that?
East St. Louis Toodaloo.
Yeah. That has kind of that Ellington kind of feel to it.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's an instrumental, and I think it's a cover, too, I think.
Yeah, I believe it is a cover of Ellington.
Because, I mean, although what I found very interesting was the, you know, my son's heard it a million times, because I've listened to it a million times. And we were watching Monk on TV one night.
Yeah.
And he went, Dad, the intro to Monk is that song you listened to with the wah-wah, wah-wah that said, and I said, holy cow, it is. And, I mean, I think you could probably lay it side by side, and yet, you know, that's another one of those genius intro pieces by Randy Newman.
Yeah. You know, I mentioned this before on the program, but in case people haven't heard, the one person who changed the way CDs sound for the better was Roger Nichols, because he realized in the 80s, at the time, what they were doing was, which is just insane, they were doing the same thing that they were doing with tapes. They thought they could get away with it, where they would recycle them. And what he did was he took them home to, and he took his home to a studio, and he would fine-tune it to hear, and you would actually hear fragments of sound in the background mixed in with what was on top of it, on top of layer on layer on layer on layer. And it's like, it's not a myth. That's really what happens. And what, and you can go back to, I guess, 87, 88, before they started doing remasters, when you hear a really tinny, tinny sound.
Yeah.
That's what Roger Nichols thought after, and he went after, and I guess he got a big, rebate for the customers too, because what they were doing was criminal, in a sense, because they were melting down everything and just using the same material over and over and over again. And that's why everything was so cheap also, but they were still charging like $12 and $13. So that's just a little piece of history.
Oh, when I think about the money I spent on CDs back in the day. Oh.
Yeah, to tell you the truth, I don't spend really, really anything. But that's another story. You know, another guy you ought to check out, Bob, is I sent you some of his stuff, is Dwelle.
Yeah.
Dwelle's amazing. He's an amazing amazing musician. He has kind of like that Fagan appeal to him. But he's from Detroit, and he grew up in the hip hop and electronic techno area. So what happened in Detroit, I don't know if people know this, but there was a DJ in Detroit who literally transformed the city, whereas when people were playing Motown, and when this was becoming more futuristic and electronicized and technology was seeping in, this guy named the Mojo would come on the air, and he would literally play back-to-back as a black DJ, which was revolutionary at its time, for this to happen at this period. And I guess the people in the UK kind of mirror him in the same way with a lot of the shows they have on BBC Radio. But what he would do is he would play back-to-back. He would play new wave, disco, techno, house, industrial, and he would seamlessly mix it into one tune after the other.
That's the genius of a great jock. You can take stuff from different genres and make it seamless.
Yeah.
And it's frankly, it's an art that's really, really hard to manifest with a CD.
It's difficult to do. It was difficult to do it in the area he was in, because every single record was, like I said, it was a different genre. He was also the first person, I believe, to start playing Prince records, which is a whole different story, because I'm one of the biggest Prince heads there is. So if anyone needs any recommendations, you can come to me, and I'll tell you straight out which ones. But one of the things that I wanted to talk about, other than music and the fact of recommending Dwelle, yeah, I'm going to mention him again.
Spell that again, please.
If you can find it, it's amazing. I'll have to send you a link again. But
okay.
The other thing I want to talk about was, did you take a look at that story? that I sent you just now?
I didn't because it says there's audio involved, and anytime I open, if I open something that's got audio involved and it starts automatically, we have another one of those train wreck shows that people that the lady complained about the other night.
Yeah.
So, does the audio open automatically?
Oh, no. I separated the link so you can go to the Raw. On the Raw story page, I also took the link out, the hyperlink, and I placed the YouTube link that played it. But anyways, for those that don't know, apparently the person who sold the Chinese ammo, who brokered it to the U.S. government, I guess, to go to Afghanistan, is a 22-year-old from Miami, and he has a MySpace page.
Oh, my God.
And the audio, people, let me tell you something. The audio is like something you would hear out of an episode of 24, maybe?
Well, that would stand to reason. That would, you know, that would.
Yeah, like it's dialogue like you wouldn't believe. Like he's talking about, he's literally a 22-year-old talking about brokering a deal, and also at the same time he's talking about, I don't want the mafia involved in this. I don't want the mafia involved in this. And this other guy, he's like, yes, I understand. Yes, and it's like a.
Yeah. Well, wait, David. Let's back up just a hair, just for those, just for those who might not be on top of this.
Yeah,
it's an astonishing story out of the paper today out of the New York Times. The House Oversight Committee is investigating a company called AEY Inc. that is a little bitty bit of nothing company.
Yeah,
that was started. And well, okay, here's the Cliff's Notes version. The Pentagon gave a $300 million contract to provide ammunition to Afghanistan to a 22-year-old with no experience. And the guy's picture's on the Raw Story. It's over at Raw Story. The guy's picture's there. I wouldn't give this guy the $10 to go get me a six-pack.
I gotta tell you what's funny about the whole story is also the ad. The ad for their company is still up on Craigslist. And Raw Story actually called him...
Craigslist? The Pentagon found him on Craigslist?
Yeah, I guess.
You're just trying to make me drink tonight, aren't you, David?
No. Wait, it gets even better. And the Raw Story decided to call up, or whoever it was, decided to call up at AEY, and they got a woman on the phone and says, are you still doing business? And they were like, we got to go now.
Nice talking to you. See ya.
That's it. We got more Chinese ammo to sell. Sorry. But his MySpace page is a riot. You guys have to see it. It says, I'm a really a nice guy.
Yeah, the two guys, 22-year-old Ephraim E. Divaroli.
Yeah.
And 25-year-old company VP David M. Pakus and general manager Levi Meyer. On the MySpace page, Divaroli says that problems in high school forced him to work through most of his teenage years, but that, quote, of course, I'm a super nice guy. I finally got a decent apartment, and I'm content for the moment. However, I definitely have the desire to be very successful in my business, and this does take up a lot of my time.
The audio to me is a stark reminder.
Jesus, this is Ferris Bueller Does Good.
The audio is a stark reminder to me that most of our arms dealers in the Third World War are going to be in their 20s.
This is nuts.
You listen to it.
I mean, this is another one of those stories that, you know, you want to... come on, please. Where's the onion watermark?
Yeah, I know. What am I
doing sitting here behind this microphone? I could walk into the I can put up something on the Craigslist and the MySpace page, and the next thing you know, the Pentagon will give me, you know, half a billion dollars. Well, Jesus, Mary and Joseph, this was a $300 million contract.
Yeah. I think they obviously did it because they were just no one really wanted to take that contract, or they just didn't want to give it to the government. Probably the latter.
In a massive piece of understatement, Raw Story writes, Vivaroli apparently had little experience in arms procurement. And the Times article suggests his dealings with the Albanian government were corrupt. The Albanians. Man.
Yeah. One more thing, and then I'll let you go because you probably have blinking lights. There is a piece on Ray Kurzweil in the New Wired on immortality and aging and vitamin supplements and technology and the singularity. 6 pages, well worth checking out. And for those, and one more bonus, for those who listen to Coast, one of my favorite physicists is going to be on. His name's Michio Kaku.
Yeah, we've talked about him.
Yeah, and he's going to be on. And I guess what I would recommend to people is, because it's on real late at night, is if you go to mininova.org, like a day afterwards, you can probably catch the torrent of the show if you type in Coast to Coast. And miniova.org is one of my favorite places to go for just picking up audio that isn't on RS links.
Cool.
I'll shorten it so we won't be criminalized.
Mininova.org.
Mininova.org. Yeah, they do a lot. A lot of people aren't up on that, but mininova.org is a really cool place where they just load up a lot of music and audio. Movies and radio shows from satellite and all kinds of different areas. So I would check that out. And probably that'll be up, I'd assume it'll probably be up Sunday or something. And the real cool thing about it is they do the feeds where they take out the commercials. So you listen to the radio broadcast and it's going to be 2 hours and 38 minutes of Michio Kaku with no radio commercials.
I have a feeling that would be a blast.
Yeah.
One of those things that kind of leaves your head swimming?
Yeah, if you can't find the link, don't worry, Bob. I'll send it to you.
Okay, cool.
The other thing, the last thing I wanted to mention was, Bob, you really got to get, did you listen? Did you watch the Aqua Teen Hunger Force?
I have not yet. We've been kind of tied up.
I got to tell you, those sound bites are perfect for Prayer Wednesday.
Oh, cool.
Prayer Night Wednesday.
Okay.
Oh, my God, Bob. I'll just give you one clue. The title is called Bible Fruit, and one of their Frylock's new MySpace friends is named Tammy Tangerine and Bert the Banana.
It's got to be good.
It is.
I don't know how those guys keep it going. It's you know, I'm one of those who just happens to think that that's pure genius.
Well, for those who didn't watch the Aqua Teen Hunger Force movie, it's going, instead of a new episode, it's going to be on this weekend. So you might want to DVR that or TiVo or whatever.
Cool. All right, then. David, good talking to you.
All right, later.
Later.
Bye.
Pop culture correspondent David from Maine. Hi, who have I got?
Susan.
Hey, Susan. How you doing, dear? How's better? Well,
okay,
more important. How's Donald?
In ICU.
Oh, mercy. Dear God.
He's got pneumonia.
Oh, pneumonia?
Yeah, pneumonia.
And they're treating, I trust?
Oh, yeah, and his blood pressure's doing funky things, so they slapped him in ICU. He's not happy.
I imagine he's not, but I imagine that's as good a place for him right now as he could possibly be.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Especially since this morning she started having chest pains, so they're pretty sure it was probably indigestion, but they don't want to take any chances. So.
No, you hook up the heart monitor and you make sure it's indigestion.
Oh, yeah. He's hooked up to a monitor to come out of the water. Anyway, the reason I called is, did you see the article about the woman who was forced by the TSA to remove her piercings?
No.
Specifically, nipple rings with pliers, no less.
What?
Yeah.
And
I put the link in.
And they got to watch, I guess.
Apparently, a woman did. They did not offer her a pat down. which they should have. They insisted she pull the nipple rings, and she managed to get one out, and then she said she was crying because apparently the scar tissue had built up and it hurt like.
Probably, you know, hurts going in, hurts coming out. One of the big arguments against nipple rings that I've always had.
Oh yeah, and so she said, I can't get it out without pliers, and so they gave her some pliers. She said she could hear.
So what? They were afraid that they were afraid the nipple rings were loaded with TNT.
Apparently.
Jesus wept. Where was this, Susan?
Lubbock.
Why do I ask?
I thought you'd get a giggle out of that.
While we're in Texas, the Texas Betsy sent me along a harrowing story. How would you like to be a teacher in New Braunfels, Texas? You know, I recognize the name New Braunfels, Texas, Susan, because my old trusty, finally rusted out after 15 long years smoker, is a New Braunfels smoker. And man, was it good. I went and looked at them recently, and they're like twice as much and much skinnier steel. But a Central Texas teacher from New Braunfels says she got a death threat over test scores. The principal said if test scores didn't meet his standards, he would kill teachers and then himself. And she says, we were just kind of sitting there in shock, and then the next statement was, you just don't know how ruthless I can be. He, of course, said it didn't happen. Now, you tell me.
I think that teacher needs to walk around with a tape recorder.
It would have been handy to have. Of course, she was a science teacher. Can't believe them science teachers, you know, they believe in things like evolution, and they don't believe that a child has the right to say that 2 and 2 equals 5 if Jesus tells them to. They want them to think it's 4.
And they believe in things like E equals MC squared.
Yeah, that dangerous communist science.
Yeah.
Lubbock nipple rings. You know, I'm all personal freedom and stuff. If you've got the guts to sit down and let somebody do that to you, you know, I think you need to. I had a pierced ear once, and that was about as much pain as I could stand.
Yeah, what are they going to do when they get some woman who walks through their scanners who has a ring in a little bit more intimate place?
Everybody's going to watch that one come out.
Or, for that matter, I've heard of guys who have rings in rather...
Don't want to talk about them. Makes me hurt just thinking about them.
I mean, this could get really icky.
But, my God, it's Lubbock, Texas. You know, how many... You make me feel like we're doing prurient radio here, Susan. How many nipple rings have been through the magnetometer at JFK? Or, God knows, SeaTac? Or LAX.
At SeaTac, probably a whole bunch.
I imagine at SeaTac they don't let you on the plane without nipple rings. San Francisco International, they'll give them to you. They give them to you with the peanuts on the plane. Okay, I'm showing my cultural bias. I'm just playing.
Well, hey, I used to work at a call center, and every day, every Halloween, people would show up dressed up. In costume. And this one person would show up as a normal person, and nobody would recognize her. Because she'd take out all of her, she'd wear makeup to cover her tats, she'd take out all of her piercings, and wear a wig to cover her mohawk, and she looked like, you know, your average, everyday stepford wife. And nobody would recognize her.
Oh, Lordy. Makes you wonder.
Oh,
just makes you wonder.
Yes. fun and games.
Never a dull moment.
Yeah. Anyway, I thought I would liven up your evening with a little bit of a giggle there.
When did this happen?
This happened, well, it was posted just over an hour ago. So it happened today.
Lord.
Civil rights investigation. She won't get it.
Well, no, the ACL, she'll probably get the investigation. The question is whether or not she can get paid.
Well, she's not asking for money. What she's asking for is an apology.
Well, good luck to her.
Yeah, that's what I say. Let's face it, we've got our very own brown shirts. They're called the TSA.
You know, it's why I get antsy about flying.
Yeah, I don't like the idea about flying either. I really don't.
And, you know, it's also why I have suggested, you know, one of these days it's going to catch on, Susan. One of these days, people are going to understand that I'm not joking about everybody needs to go to, you know, either ladies, you know, regardless of size or shape, flip-flops and a string bikini, and guys, it's flip-flops and Speedo. And they can't bitch. Well, you know, it's a perfect protest, at least as far as I can tell. So, you know, worth thinking about.
The thought of me in a string bikini is just horrifying.
No, the thought of me in a Speedo. Jiminy. The horror, you know, straight out of Heart of Darkness. Oh my God.
Yes.
But the thing is, if it's an entire plane full of people in flip-flops and Speedo, we're all equal. And we're only doing it to protect the nation, Susan.
Yes. Sir.
We're only doing it because we love our country and we want to do our duty to fight the terst.
And make the TSA look like the idiots they are.
Well, there is that added bonus.
Yes.
and there it is. Now in the chat room, they've got me, the dancing Bob guy in the Speedo.
Oh, aren't you cute, Bob?
No, I'm so not.
Oh.
What are we going to do? Peter's show can't get here soon enough.
Hey. Suffer through, Bob.
I know. Hey, tell Donald we're thinking about him and we love him, okay?
Okay, I will.
All right. Take care, Susan.
Love to Agnes.
Thanks. Bye now.
Bye-bye.
Just another day in Bushmerica. Getting your nipple rings yanked out at Lubbock International Airport. By the way, since David brought up the story about the $300 million ammunition contract to the 22-year-old slacker, stuff going in the other direction. Remember when the right wing had a hissy about L'Oreal Corporation? Bill Clinton selling our high technology missiles to the Chi-Coms. Remember that? Dateline Washington. The U.S. military shipments to Taiwan was supposed to be helicopter batteries. Definitely helicopter batteries. Of course, I'm an excellent helicopter pilot. Fly slow on the driveway. But when the boxes arrived in fall 2006, they contained electrical fuses used in missile warheads, and it took the Pentagon nearly 2 years to figure out the mix-up. Moment. I got to get the windscreen off the microphone. That's my head. On Tuesday, the shipment to Taiwan of four of the classified fuses for an intercontinental ballistic missile set off a broad investigation. No, I'm not going to do that one-liner. I'm absolutely not going to do that one-liner. It's just too easy. Broad investigation. So you got that. Then on the other end of the spectrum, just because, you know, there's a certain lovely symmetry to all of this hopeless incompetence on the part of the Bush administration. The former president of Texas A&M University, who could barely beat the Baylor Bears and therefore cannot be expected to beat the Baghdad Baathists, issued an interesting little order today, or in the last day or so. Robert Gates, for reasons that are not immediately apparent on its face, suddenly formally ordered the Air Force, Navy, and Defense Logistics Agency to conduct an inventory of all U.S. nuclear weapons and nuclear weapon-related materials in order to make sure that all items are accounted for. That came out today. Are we missing any nukes? Oh, wait a minute. I remember a certain flight from North Dakota to Barksdale Air Force Base. Huh. Wonder if this one's going to turn up a missing nuke somewhere that just might happen to go off in an airburst over Tehran. It is hard living with this much paranoia inside my skull. But it's not, I don't think it's paranoia anymore. I think it's really ugly, hateful reality. Oh, wait a minute. Yeah, okay, it ties together. The order comes in the wake of the discovery last week that four nuclear warhead fuses were accidentally shipped to Taiwan, which means that somewhere out there there are four nuclear missiles that don't have fuses on them, I guess. Or maybe they just went down to the Napa and got the nuclear missile fuses. How big is a fuse for a nuclear missile? Somebody help me here. Gates's memo calls for all items to be accounted for by serial number. It's probably a faith-based serial number. It's going to take 60 days. They've got 60 days to pull this inventory together. That means they've got 60 days to make the mushroom cloud happen over Baghdad, or over Tehran, or Bushehr, and claim that we didn't mean to do that. That was a mistake. Oopsie daisy. Well, it's time for me to bail out of here. Peter Godbold may have a bit of a scratchy voice, but he's going to get through 2 hours this evening. He's got a fabulous guest, Paul Parker, a dance music pioneer, on his way with Strictly Confidential. After that, the horn section, John and I lighten it up again, and all foxed up coming your way at midnight Eastern time, it's Billy Shear's music time. It's Thursday. So I think you'll be looking forward to that. I hope you are. I am. Thanks to Peter and to John, our IT professional and chief engineer, respectively. Thanks to the hardest working man in liberal talk, Ben Birch, WhiteRoseSociety.org. He's raising funds. He needs your help. Just like the horn needs your help. We're a long way away from meeting our March goal, and we've only got, it's like Jerry Reed said, long way to go, a short time to get there. Three days to go $600 and change. If you can help me, if you can help Peter, if you can help Mark Levine, if you can help John Fox, if you can help the horn, please do so either with our PayPal button or by snail mail to 1038 North Eisenhower Drive, PMB 318, Beckley, West Virginia, 25801. And that way you'll make sure that Conversation Radio continues. Ben Birch has his contribution information at WhiteRoseSociety.org. Many thanks. Many, many thanks to the hardworking people at Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net. Be a member. It's easy. It's not expensive. And you'll know that you're part of the solution that will create a sustainable future for Appalachia and West Virginia. And always, 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 RMR, Gina, it's all for you.
It's your second hour in the Liberal Sandbox, and you're head on.
America and good morning, world. Welcome to book chapter and verse 130